Talk about two events that are happening this evening in the San Francisco Bay Area, both in Berkeley for that matter, and both at the same time. So your choices are going to be, it's going to be a hard choice. However, I'll leave that up to you. Our first interview is with the founder and artistic director of Navarasa Dance Theater. Her name is Dr. Aparna Sidhor, and she and her company, co-directors, are bringing their current production, Encounter, to La Peña Cultural Center tonight, Thursday, October 11th at 8 p.m. And Encounter is based on the story of an indigenous woman, Dopti, inspired by Magasese award-winning writer Mahasweta Devi's work, and adapted for the stage by S.M. Ruju and Dr. Sidhor. Encounter explores imageries from the history and world around, whether it's in the Native American history or indigenous people's history elsewhere, or a modern-day occurrence in Iraq or Afghanistan or Rwanda. Dr. Mohan Agashe, veteran Indian actor, says, Encounter is a powerful piece. It's gorgeously staged. The dances are beautiful, and the impact of the show makes one think about it for a long time. So this particular piece, I thought, was actually 2 days. I thought it was, yeah, it is. It is tonight. It is also Friday evening, and La Peña Cultural Center is in Berkeley, 3105 Shattuck Avenue. And so it's going to really be wonderful. So we had an opportunity to speak to the choreographer yesterday afternoon between rehearsals. And so we're going to bring that interview to you now. And then after that, we're going to follow that interview up with a special interview with director Billy Woodbury, who has a wonderful, wonderful work that's a part of the L.A. Rebellion, Northern California, which which was a part of the L.A. Standard art exhibit in Los Angeles last year. And so I'm looking right now for the details on that. And trying to think. I guess I could just share that with you when. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a really, really wonderful piece. Bless their little hearts. And it was directed in. Was directed in 1984, and this is a restored print, and it's going to be seeded by the pocketbook, which was the director's Billy Woodbury's second film in 1980, and it was based on a poem by Langston Hughes, and you're going to really love the music in his work. It's just really gorgeous, and so. I'll read you a little bit of the filmmaker's bio when we come back. So here's the interview with Dr. Aparna Sidhore about Navarasa's West Coast premiere of Encounter. Tell me about this latest work from your company, Encounter.
So, Encounter, I mean, you know, we created this work actually in several different versions of it. Initially, it was created as a solo years ago. I used to do it as a one-on-one show.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2010, so the co-directors of the show, Anil Nativeda and S.M. Raju, and I, we kind of like wanted to remake this show as an ensemble piece. So this show Encounter actually, you know, emerged from that idea of like looking at the word encounter and also exploring different meanings of encounter, you know. So the first half of the production is like several different dance encounters with like Encounter with Divine and Encounter with Self and Encounter with Bob Marley and things like that. Although what we are presenting here is the larger theater piece, which is Encounter with the Military, which is inspired by a short story by Mahashweta Devi. She's one of the well-known Indian writers and activists.
Mm-hmm.
So this encounter it has a specific meaning, like within the South Asian context, you know, the word encounter is also used in the context of when the police or the military, you know, captures people, like especially the indigenous people, they say they were encountered, meaning like they were killed or tortured or, you know, you name it. It's like an euphemism for that. So this show kind of explores that meaning, but then the show is actually a show of defiance from the indigenous community.
Oh, so encounter is a euphemism for killing someone?
Yeah, something like that.
I never heard that one before. Yeah. I mean, there are so many, like, friendly fire. And,
yeah.
But encounter, I never heard that one. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that is amazing. So tell me about your company and how many are part of this particular piece.
So the original piece with Encounter was, like, created with 9 performers.
Mm-hmm.
And for this tour, you know, we are having total 6 performers.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, you know, co-written by S.M. Raju, myself, and Anil Nativeda, and we co-directed it, and then 6 of us performed this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a company, you know, with largely South Asian dancers and some dancers from, you know, Boston area, and so... Mm-hmm. That's how it is composed of.
Yeah, where is your company located?
In Boston and also in India.
Oh.
So we have like 2 bases.
What part of India?
In South India.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Ah, so a lot of indigenous folks in the southern part of India.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. So, Navarasa, what does that mean, Navarasa?
It's okay. Navarasa means, you know, in the Indian aesthetic theory, like the highest artistic experience is the experience of rasa. So, Navarasa means like 9 rasas or new rasas. Like, so, there are 9 various ways one could experience a performance,
mm-hmm.
any performance, not just dance or theater or anything, anything, even art. So, you know, in that sense, like, the rasas are always growing because previously it used to be 8, then they said it's 9, so I like that name because it's always like, you know, more experiences and expressions can come through. So,
So is there like energy as well?
Sorry?
Is there like energy? The
energy, yeah, like energy, experience and
mm-hmm.
feeling and taste.
Mm-hmm.
So all can be encompassed in one word called rasa.
Oh, that makes sense because dance is movement, and
correct.
It sounds like philosophically it's about moving, huh?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Moving through it, moving beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, interesting. Ah, so tell us about. So, were you born in this part of India that you go back and forth, or are
yes?
You...
yes and no. I mean, like I was born in Mysore, which is in South India, also. So you know, part of our company work happens in Mysore and you know, Kerala and Tamil Nadu. So basically, all states of South India we cover.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. And. So is your company, for instance, do people, I mean, I know sometimes people say that, you know, everyone can dance, so
mm-hmm.
certain companies are, like, really accessible to the community.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be an elitist
mm-hmm.
or have a lot of money to be able to dance.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, is your company like that, that it's a part of the community?
Yes, yes. I mean, we believe in, like, you know, we actually have a project called Dance for Everyone, which is a free dance training program for underprivileged kids and youth.
Mm-hmm.
So two of the dancers who are performing with us in this show they came from that project. So, you know, what we started doing is because, like, you know, for the privileged, dance and music and art is, like, very accessible, and for people who don't have the resources, it just becomes, like, such an effort to have access to dance. I mean, learning dance, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we wanted to provide them that on an ongoing basis rather than, like, here is one-time workshop you enjoy, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we have hired teachers who go teach every week to the kids and youth.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you know, yes, everybody can dance, and then if you want to be good at it, then you have to dance more. So we believe in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the more you dance, the better one gets at it. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
for joy, everybody can dance. If you want to do that, do it at a professional level, then you have to get good at it by practice and training and working with right people.
Right, yeah. I noticed I was just looking at your bio, and it's extremely eclectic around dance. You know, some of the people you dance with and companies. I know the Urban Bush Women, and I really like their work.
Yeah,
and
I love them. Yeah,
yeah.
Because we train our artists, you know, in dance and yoga, and also
mm-hmm.
a martial arts called Kalaripayattu.
Right.
So Anil Nativedha, who is the co-director, he is actually a master Kalaripayattu artist.
Oh.
So, you know, core training is also in that. And music and theater. So we think of art as a whole rather than, oh, we do dance and we do song, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We do everything and more.
Right, that's why you're a theater.
Yeah, exactly. That's
mm-hmm.
why we are theater. Correct.
Right, yeah. And you have a... You are a gold medalist in dance from Mysore University. Is that how you pronounce that?
Mysore, yes.
Yeah, where is that?
That's in South India. That's where I'm from.
Okay. You're like super famous. You're like a rock star. Southern India, I'm sure. And you have a PhD in dance, culture, and women's studies from Boston University.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm sure that sort of really... informs the stories that you tell, huh?
Yeah, I mean, not because of the PhD or anything. It's just, you know, I'm very interested in reading and learning, and I feel like it never ends, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Encounter, which production is this for your company?
I mean, we have, like, about 15 full-length productions.
Okay.
So this is the latest one.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
yeah.
You know, we'll be working on something.
And you also work in film. Have any of your pieces been adapted for film?
Yeah, both Anil and I, we both choreographed for a Malayalam film, which is a South Indian language.
Mm-hmm.
And also I choreographed for another film called Varanam, which was actually made by S.M. Raju, who is the co-writer of the show.
Mm-hmm.
He's a filmmaker by profession. So, you know, I choreographed for that as well.
Right. So, how did you happen to choose La Pena Culture Center, you know, Berkeley, to bring your work?
Actually, you know, one of our managers, Bhavana, she had kind of, I don't know how she found it, but she contacted them and she was like, oh, they sound amazing, they're doing amazing work, maybe we can take our show. Because we were anyway coming to California on a tour. We performed in LA, like we did about 24 shows in Los Angeles.
Okay.
So we thought we should make a visit to the Bay Area, and then she said, oh, La Pena will be great for us, and you know. So then she contacted CC, and then it just started like that.
Oh, wow. That is so nice because, you know, La Pena is just a part of the community.
Yeah, exactly.
And
they have been amazing, you know. They're really amazing here.
Wow. That's great. That's really great. And so after your 2 days at La Pena, you know, Thursday, October 11th, and Friday, October 12th, where are you all off to next?
Next, we are doing a small presentation at Yerba Buena in San Francisco. That's just part of the Yerba Buena night, but then we go back to Boston. We are doing some work at the Brandeis University.
So has Boston University, since you you graduated from there, have they been like really supportive in your work, with your work?
Since I graduated, not really. You know, maybe
nope.
I should. This is time to approach them.
You're an all-star graduate. I mean, you know, they definitely should associate themselves with you.
Yeah, and keep that in mind.
Yeah, with money.
Exactly, that's what we need.
Right. Wow. Well, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
And I'm so happy you're visiting us here in the San Francisco Bay Area. That is just so wonderful, considering it's a community-based organization.
Yeah.
You know, you're not at a really expensive, you know, inaccessible or off-putting type of venue.
No,
I mean,
not at all. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the regular folks are going to come see you.
Exactly. That's the best thing, you know.
Right.
Because they can really, because it's a story and there is theater, so people really connect to it. And people, you know, we need people laughing and crying with us, you know.
I was watching some of the preview stills with the music. I'm like, ooh, that looks really compelling. And do you have live musicians or?
We have recorded music. And also a lot of the songs we sing live. All the dancers sing, I sing. So we have live drums and, you know, a lot of like rhythms with sticks and, you know.
Wow. Do you bring in traditional instruments, Indian instruments?
Yeah, we have like the kokolu, which is like the sticks that we play in folk songs. And then we have something called khanjira, which is like a, you know, which is used by both folk artists and also classical musicians.
I really like the ceremony of Indian music. It's a real, there's ritual involved, and it's real serious too. Even though you're having fun. It's really, really nice. It's different. It's a difference. That's really lovely. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much. I hope you can come see the show.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out.
Okay.
I need to clone myself.
Yeah, please.
All right, you take good care.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sure, peace
and
blessings.
Nice talking to you.
Oh, nice talking to you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So once again, we were speaking to the founding artistic director of Navarasa Dance Theater, Dr. Aparna Sidhor, and this theater was founded in 1991. And again, it's inspired by the eclectic performing arts traditions, boldly knitting together dance, singing, martial arts, and original music into seamless theatrical presentations. Navarasa's multi-layered, multilingual productions inspire, engage, and entertain audiences around the world. Original movement vocabulary created by choreographer Aparna Sidhor and Anil Natyaveda, along with theatrical narratives designed by S.M. Raju. Navarasa Dance Theater's work is specific and universal at the same time. And you ought to see this image on the website for LaPena.org. It is like, oh, my God, I definitely have to be there. So, again,
The theater opens with Encounter tonight, Thursday, October 11th at 8 p.m. Advance tickets are available. You can visit La Pena's website. And let me see if I can find their home really quickly and give you a phone number. Let's see. The phone number is, I am not seeing it. Let's see. One more try. Maybe I can find it here. I know it's 510, but I don't remember the rest. Don't see it. Okay. Oh, yeah, here it is. Tickets, 510-849-2568, 510-849-2568, extension 20. And you get tickets between 2:30 and 6:30 during the week. And you can also get tickets at the door. You can also do walk-up. And La Pena is really close to Ashby Avenue in Berkeley, but it's on Shattuck. It's 3105 Shattuck Avenue, and it's really public transportation accessible. Mr. Billy Woodbury, who is going to be in town, he's going to be flying in a little bit later on today, not this early in the morning probably. He is an independent filmmaker who graduated from the University of California, Los Angeles Film Television Department with a Master's in Fine Arts and Production. He has appeared in several films by Charles Burnett, and one of those films, It's Raining or something to that effect, I think it's called It's Raining. He's going to be, the film is screening next week, which is Thursday, October 18th. So that's going to be really fun seeing him, in front of the camera, because you don't see him in front of the camera often. But he said he'd do anything for Charles Burnett, whom he called Charlie. So anyway, he's appeared in several films by Charles Burnett, Tom Anderson, and James Binning. His works have screened at the Canberra Austria Symposium, Harvard Film Archive, Human Rights Watch Film Festival, and Museum of Modern Art. He has taught in the art school and the film video school at CalArts since 1989. So he's an institution, and has been a member of the board of the Film Forum Los Angeles since 1998 as well. Tonight, his film Bless Your Little Heart, which is like seminal work for him, everyone knows this film, it's just such a classic, is a new print, is screening tonight along with his other film, The Pocketbook, which I already mentioned earlier. And he's got another film, which I don't know, but I think I've heard of, In My Father's House. And it's a powerful civil rights leader is forced to renounce his present and confront his past when the son he abandoned reappears. Sounds like Amen Corner a little bit, only as a father as opposed to a woman who is sort of acknowledging her past. Bless Their Little Hearts, 1984. Represents the closure and pinnacle of a neo-realist strand within what's now described as the L.A. Rebellion, which dates to Charles Burnett's Several Friends in 1969. Woodbury's film chronicles the devastating effects of underemployment on a family in the same Los Angeles community depicted in Killer of Sheep. That was Charles Burnett's film in 1977. And it pays witness to the ravages of time in the short years since its predecessor. Nate Hartman and Casey Moore deliver gut-wrenching performances as the couple whose family is torn apart by events beyond their control. If salvation remains, it's in the sensitive depiction of everyday life, which persists throughout the film. By 1978, when Bless's production began, Burnett, then 34, was already an elder statesman and mentor to many within the UCLA film community. And it was he who encouraged Woodbury to pursue a feature-length work. In a telling act of trust, Burnett offered the newcomer a startlingly intimate 70-page original scenario and also shot the film. He furthermore connected Woodbury with his cast of friends and relatives, many of whom had appeared in Killer of Sheep, solidifying the two films' connections. Yet critically, he then held back further instruction, leaving Woodbury to develop the material, direct, and edit. As Woodbury reveals, quote, he would deliberately restrain himself from giving me the solution to things, end quote. The first time feature director delivered brilliantly, and I agree with this depiction that I'm reading from the LA Rebellion Creating a New Black Cinema Program booklet, which you can pick up a souvenir copy of at PFA this evening at the screening. So anyway, and the result of this film, Bless Their Little Hearts, is an ensemble work that represents the culminative visions of Woodbury Burnett and their excellent cast. Whereas Burnett's original scenario placed emphasis on the spiritual crisis of Hardiman's Charlie Binks, the then-married Woodbury, alongside Moore and Hardiman, further developed the domestic relationship within the film and articulated the depiction of a family struggling to stay alive in a world of rapidly vanishing prospects. In retrospect, the film's ending can be seen as a spiritual goodbye, not just for Banks, but for Burnett, who would move away from his neo-realist work with his next film, the classic To Sleep With Anger, 1990, for Woodbury, who moved into documentary, and for Hardiman, who left acting shortly after. The film remains an unforgettable landmark in American cinema, and that was written by Ross Lippman. And then the pocketbook, which is screening this evening, is a short, and again, it's based on a poem by Langston Hughes, and the poem is called Thank You, Ma'am. And it features the music of Lead Belly, Thelonious Monk, and Miles Davis. And because the music in Bless Their Little Hearts is so phenomenal, I thought since Archie Shepp is in town, and Archie Shepp, I believe, calls Los Angeles his home, I thought we'd perhaps play a piece from Archie Shepp. And Archie Shepp, he makes, like, serious statements. And I don't know, I played Cousin Mary before, and Cousin Mary would probably work really well. So would Revolution, for that matter. But I thought Arrival would be nice because Mr. Woodbury is arriving. He's going to be coming in. He's going to be arriving in town. And I thought this would be a nice sort of salute to his travel, you know, north from Southern California to be with us today. So this is for him. This is for Mr. Woodbury. And then we're going to go right into this interview, which is about 50 minutes long. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you. So that is Archie Shepp, Arrival. And we opened the show with...
Arrival, written by Horace Parlin. En commémoration du blues, nous avons la chanson de Bessie Smith, enregistrée en 1920. Ça s'appelle Backwater Blues. Backwater Blues.
So Archie Shepp, and he's in town tonight and tomorrow night, Thursday and Friday, the 11th and 12th. There's just too much stuff happening, right? And I had tickets to give away to the 10 o'clock show for tonight, the 11th, and only had one response. So I guess I'm going to have two pair left if anyone's interested. You can... you know, hit me up here on the radio show, you know, comment. Blog Talk, which means you can blog, right? So hit me up, let me know if you're interested, leave me your name and an email address and I will respond to you. Like I said, I have two pair left for the 10 o'clock show. And again, we open with Louisa Maita singing Amor and Peace. I thought Love and Peace would be a nice way to open the special broadcast. And now we're going to go right into this wonderful conversation with director Billy Woodbury, who is going to be at the theater this evening, Pacific Film Archive, UC Berkeley's Pacific Film Archive, to open his film, Bless Their Little Hearts, and take comments afterwards. So this is a really long, wonderful interview. So sit back, drink your coffee, and just enjoy.
So I was wondering if you could tell us first, Mr. Woodbury, about sort of the whole idea of what brought you into filmmaking. I read that you're, you know, were born in Dallas, Texas. Were you raised there too?
Until I was 17, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I just love the name of the series that was in Los Angeles during the, what was it called, the L.A. Standard, L.A. Rebellion, because I was in Los Angeles and I couldn't stay long enough to be able to catch in the films, and I'm so happy that it's on tour, not all of the films, but quite a few of them, and I just love the way... the various directors, you all work on each other's films, and you're in some of each other's films, and you do the music, you know, one person's doing the music on somebody else's film, and then the next person's film, you know, you see them as cinematographers. So it's really cool. So why don't you talk about that whole image making that was sort of seemed really flourishing at the time you were at the in L.A. at the School of Film and Video?
Okay, where to start? I think what happened is, first of all, I think that term or that concept and idea was started by a scholar and a writer named Clyde Taylor, who at the time lived in the Bay Area and taught at Berkeley. And he used to publish reviews and articles about film in different places, but one place was Black Collegian. And then later in the 80s, he did a presentation at the Whitney Museum in New York, and this was the concept and idea that he came up with for his talk and to encapsulate his thinking about what happened in Los Angeles during the 1970s and early 80s or whatever. And then he sort of he proposed that these films came out of the UCLA School of Film and Television at the time. from young people that were studying in graduate school and undergraduate school at the University of California, Los Angeles. And so then that concept got taken up, that idea and that label got taken up by different programmers, curators, and other younger scholars started to investigate it and write about it and think about it and that kind of thing. And then finally, after years, the UCLA Film and Television Archive was able to mount this big exhibition, relatively large, 51 films or something like that, at the Hammer Museum over some months in the fall of last year. And now it's sort of touring around. Myself, what happened was, I suppose, after... In some ways, you know, I mean, the 60s and all of that in the country and in the world was a kind of tumultuous time. And also, it's post the civil rights movement, the black consciousness movement, black power movement. It's, you know, an aftermath of that that we came to study film. And but the thing is that was a time, I think, of great optimism and also unprecedented opportunities and access for some younger people and others in the black community as a consequence of the struggles of the civil rights movement and the black consciousness movement. In the United States, the social movements, wider social movements, the movements against the war in Vietnam and for social justice and that kind of thing. I think one consequence in the black, among the black community or the black population or African American later, is the term, is that there was a great optimism because for the first time people were gaining access and experiences that were beyond what could have been imagined 10, 15, 20 years before. And I think that optimism encouraged people to widen their interest, their curiosity, and that kind of thing. Another thing that happened in the early 70s is there was a whole... I mean, there was a kind of popular, in the popular commercial film world, they started to take on black subject matter, and they tried to respond to and ultimately, you know, exploit for their own purposes some of the, you know, the presence of and the sort of new recognition and the sort of prevalence of black cultural figures and cultural expression and new sort of attitudes and new ways of self-representation and that kind of thing. And so movies started to come out during this, you know, in this popular commercial movies that played in the big theaters and all the big inner cities and urban places in the U.S. There were some unique and singular examples that also came about in the commercial and in the independent, what became the independent film expression as it grew and developed in the early 70s. Late 60s. If you think about it, people like Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte, who had been actors in movies since the 50s and that kind of thing, like Sidney Poitier started to direct films. His first film, which I saw recently, actually watched the whole thing and found it quite an admirable movie. And it touched on many of the themes that preoccupied even some of my peers, but I don't know that we would have recognized it as such at the time. That film, Buck and the Preacher.
Oh, yeah, I like that film. Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, one of our schoolmates, Pamela Jones, who acts in the film, in a number of the films, Ben Caldwell's film and Larry Clark's film, she acted in the movie. Okay, she plays a young woman who's taken hostage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really ask her much. She was also in another film that they made at the time, made by a former Blacklist director. I think it was Jules Dessin, who ended up, after, you know, going to Europe in the Blacklist, and he ended up marrying Melina Mercouri, the Greek actress, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but he made a film called Uptight, which was a remake of a John Ford movie, you know, with Raymond St. Jacques, and Pamela was also in that film. So, okay, that was going on. Then you had the initiative of people like Mr. Melvin Van Peebles, who came back from France after years living in Europe, and he made a film at Columbia, Warner Brothers, or one of them, called Watermelon Man. And at the same time, he built the...
That was good with Garth Cambridge.
Yeah, he built the conditions for himself to even strike out in a more original way and make a film that probably wouldn't have been acceptable at the time in the studio system. But he made his own film. It's called Sweet Sweet Back, you know. So those films were coming out. Then Mr. Gordon Parks, he made the popular movie with a, you know, striking urban hero guy, you know, in cool clothes and great soundtrack by Isaac Hayes, a chef movie, right? So those movies were around. Then Mr. Parks had made earlier his autobiographical film, The Learning Tree, and those things. So people were doing that. The other thing for us, though, I think, and so... I mean, it was obvious and apparent that there was no sort of... It was possible for people of our type, our so-called race, we could do this. It was not a deficit that we had, right? And others, we learned later, right, about other examples and that kind of thing. But at the time, it seems possible to do things. And I was not in the first group of these people. People like Charles Burnett had already suspected that you could do it, right? And he had wanted to be a cameraman, and he ended up in film school. He did an undergraduate degree in film, and then he did a master's in film. And Larry Clark, Haile Gerima, and all those people ended up here at UCLA. So they were sort of first and second group. And then others of us started to suspect maybe it's an interesting thing to try. It was not unique to us because since the 1950s, after the Second World War, since the time of the Italian neorealist people who impressed upon the world that you didn't need all the huge infrastructure and apparatus to make a film, you didn't really... It didn't really require that the people be professional, that they be stars or that they be professional actors, you know, that one could make a film without those things and one could maybe get closer to a certain kind of reality without them, right? So you had that example. Then you had the exciting example of the French New Wave and all that followed throughout the world, right, in Japan and all India and all different places, you know. There was a change about, change of foot in cinema. And we were, you know, so we sort of followed in the wake of that. We followed in the wake of the new Latin American cinema, the new Cuban cinema, new African cinema, you know, begun by Ousmane Sembène and Suleiman Sissé and Omara Ganda and all of those people in Africa, you see. And very quickly, fortunately for us, we were able, through some of the initiative of one faculty member here, Alicia Taylor, and then later one of our colleagues, but who became one of the leading thinkers and writers about this, Tashomi Gabriel, we pretty soon organized so that we had access to a lot of this new cinema that was coming from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And that was very inspiring and reassuring and gave us permission to try something, you see. And then we discovered, because we had the privilege of being at film school, which had enormous resources, you know, relatively speaking, compared to what we had access to before. But it also had the archives, the memory of the cinema, and we had courses on the history of cinema, and we had courses on the work of Charlie Chaplin and all these things. And so you could be in an environment where, if you wanted to, you could be inundated and swim in images and film, like, you know, for 12 hours a day, you know, without stop. And then, so I think that's part of what the time was like, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the idea that, okay, if you make film, if you make a film, like, film also has the possibility to be a work of a way to be involved in political and social change and in the, you know, in cultural life, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that you shouldn't neglect that. It's not mere sheer entertainment and distraction, you see. And we sort of bought into that in some ways. Then the people who were ahead of me, they also had the idea that, okay, what should happen is, okay, now we have access to this university education. And there was the attempt to inculcate the value that, okay, but don't lose the link to the people who nourished you and what brings you here and who in some ways made this opportunity possible, and don't share in it. So how do we connect what we're learning, be it law or psychology or sociology or history or whatever, like, how do we sustain and build the links and share this in the wider community, black community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they organized initiatives like that, along with other young people in the arts who wanted to be actors, who wanted to have theater, who wanted to have dance, who wanted to have music, and that kind of thing. And so in doing that, they made links with the wider black community in Los Angeles, you know, that nourished, fed, and provided us, right, with people that we could work with who were in some ways on the same mission. And if you came to, like, I'm in a kind of second group of them, a third group, actually. And what happens is, by the time I came, they had developed, quite a number of people, connections with a number of people, and people had acted in these student films. And then you had kind of built up a kind of company, a group of people that you could go to and appeal to them to appear in your film. They understood what you were asking them to do. They understood, you know, that in some ways you were beginning, and they were apt to be bored for long stretches while they were waiting, right, for you to prepare the scene or the action or whatever it was that you were doing. They, you know, and they were able to tolerate that, and they gave a lot to those films. So part of the story of those films is in what I'm expressing, I hope, that was sort of how it happened.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, that was, I mean, it just seemed really marvelous that you were able to step into this particular environment that already had been established. I mean, you didn't have to set it up. I mean, it already existed. So the support was there for your artistic work. And I was wondering who was there when you arrived, because I was just sort of been going to all the films, and I have, like, I mean, I already knew Julie Dash's work and Haile Gerima's work and Charles Burnett's work, but I didn't know Larry Clark and Ben Caldwell, oh my goodness, and Jamal Bonica and Ali Sharon Larkin and Zanabu Irene Davis. I mean, oh my goodness.
Well, a lot of those people you named, with the exception of the woman you named near the end, mm-hmm. they were here. Also, Jamal Fanaka and others, they came. He, Ben, and a number of other people came after Haile, Charlie, Larry, and those people.
Mm-hmm.
And but they were not so far, you know, apart in age experience and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Sometimes they might be older, but they were just returning to school or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah. The others were ahead of you in the course. And it was, this is something that I'm noticing with storytelling. It's like you can oversimplify things and you can remove the complexities in order to have a kind of coherent narrative. And what's missed in that is that it was a process and it was a kind of struggle and you kind of had, okay, the conditions were there, but to actually realize them, okay, you had to earn that, you had to contribute, you had to be involved, you had to seek it out.
Mm-hmm.
But they had, I want to acknowledge that because they had gone before and they had done it before, that in some ways it did exist. And in some ways, what I'm telling you is we recognize that in hindsight.
Oh.
And it's a matter of wanting to acknowledge it because if you don't, then you kind of can exaggerate how clever you were, and things just kind of happen like that. But a lot of people gave up their Saturdays and their Sundays, you know, who are not known or recognized until the films are seen, and then people go, wow, but it's like maybe too late, right, in terms of them having any major benefit from it. So that's why I think it's important to acknowledge it, and then we share that. Those relationships, you know, if you had, if I inherited actors from Haile, from Larry, and all of those people, which I did, then I'm kind of responsible to maintain and sustain that relationship so that a Lele can have access to the same person. Mm-hmm. If I ruin it, then my reputation in the community is not so great, and also I let down on what I was given. That was sort of a kind of ethics that I think prevailed in that community, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like there was an initiation kind of process as well.
There's initiation, and Haile Gerima used to say, don't talk of film, show a film.
Mm-hmm.
And also because you came into a situation where they were struggling and they had, maybe they had gone through it and they knew what you had to do, and sometimes they were your teaching assistant or whatever. And they kind of, your initiation was to go ahead and do what you had signed on for.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll help you and we'll support you, but you need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think encouraged and made possible for more of us to complete that part of it than if that had been absent, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking, besides most of the films being really interdisciplinary, I mean, you know, the film that you've got, The Pocketbook, which is going to, I believe, screen with, Bless Their Little Hearts, this Thursday, the 11th at PFA, it's based on, you know, a Langston Hughes poem, and then secondly, I was just thinking about these films, which what I love about them so much is that they're set in the community. I mean, we're in Compton, you know, we're in Watts, you know, we're in the Black community, we're in people's homes, and these people are people that we live with. So it's just like, wow, but it's a movie. I mean, you know, it's like on a screen, and it's big, and it's familiar.
Well, that was part of the effort, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Watts loom large in the imagination of the, you know, the country and the world because of it. What happened in 1965, but also a lot of initiatives around culture were started in Watts, and even sometimes we weren't fully aware of all the connections in history, but it had a kind of meaning, you know, and a kind of thing in our imagination and in the social and political world of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why, you know, if we had been in another place, maybe another place, right? But that was where the people were.
Mm-hmm.
And But they were, the films are actually a pretty good mapping of the city and a kind of geography that one is reminded of when you watch them. If you know the city, how much of it they actually represent or display, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one good thing about them. Actually, in this man Tom Anderson's film, Los Angeles Plays Itself, one reason he values them is because they show places and parts of the city that are sort of off the grid or outside the imagination of the tourist board and, you know, the sort of romantic image or whatever that's, you know, given to the world through Hollywood movies and TV shows, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was kind of a way to include them. And then we had colleagues who were Japanese American, Mexican American, and others, right? We had a young Vietnamese woman. We had foreign students. They were a big part of our education, from Iran and Egypt and all those, and Africa and all of that. They did a lot to educate us, to encourage us, to, you know, and working together with them. And the progressive white students at the school. It was a radical kind of school and a good school. It was a people's school. So we had all of that. And while this thing talks about L.A. Rebellion and sort of focus on this African-American group and community, we all acknowledge and have said always publicly that it was broader and richer than that.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's not rich and broad in itself and central and important to understand in the country and the place and the whole and the culture.
Mm-hmm.
But we just acknowledge that because it's true. And we're not sure that without those people who were part of our third world cinema club and all our debates and things, you know, that the films would have been as rich as they are.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then it wasn't just specifically African-American either. It was, you know, Pan-African, because you had students from the Caribbean and Afro-Caribbean and Africa, like you already mentioned, and Europe, and, you know, African people of African descent from throughout the diaspora were a part of, you know, these various schools that, you know, you came in on the third wave, I believe you said, or the second wave.
Yeah. That's important but that's a part of the, that was a part of the discourse and part of the culture of the time, you know, the idea of the third world, the idea of our connection to Africa, to Latin America, to all of those things, you know. It's part of the inheritance from people like Langston Hughes and from the Negritude people and from others. Yeah, we were fortunate in that at that time in school, you could learn that. You had courses, you had people, you had an interest in the wider world in that way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seemed really holistic.
And that was rich.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our reality, you know.
Right, yeah, and it certainly comes through, you know, through in the films that, you know, we've been, you know, able to see and experience over the course of, you know, since September through the end of this month, which is just really fabulous. Wonder if you could talk a little bit about your relationship, you know, with Charles Burnett and your film Bless Their Little Hearts, which is a classic, and there's it's a restored print, so it's looking even better than it looked, you know, when it was last seen, you know, in this current edition of it.
He's a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
I met him at school here, and what happened was we worked together at the end of that small film, the pocketbook film. He helped me. He shot the latter part of the movie. So, but he was around, and at the time he worked, so he only came in the evenings to edit his thesis film. So it was difficult to meet him. Eventually I met him, we became friends, and over time we spent a lot of time talking. And what happened was, it tended to happen because of personalities and different things. A lot of our sort of, those figures like Larry Clark, Hailey, Charles, been, and other people, you inherit that position and responsibility toward the people that come after you. Some of us do it better than, we're able to do it better than others, but it was a kind, they kind of, you sort of gravitated towards some who became sort of like mentors without having official responsibility or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so some gravitated to Hailey, some gravitated to Charlie, some gravitated to Ben, some gravitated to Larry. And you might end up working with them directly. A lot of times, one thing you were encouraged to do when you come here is they say you only learn by working on films. So you work on films of others, and also what you do is you build a kind of sweat equity so that you're known as a person who's reliable, responsible, and willing to work on others' films. So when you need help, they work on your films, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the responsibility and the relationships that existed. It happened that I became sort of close with him, and eventually we were talking, and I was needing to make the thesis film, and I had different ideas, and I there were two expensive, ambitious, and different things, and eventually he told me, I have a story for you. And we can do this without, great deal of money, but it'd be a long film and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the story, and yeah, I'll do the script, and we'll do that thing. So that's how we came to do that film together.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a gift and a challenge, as mm-hmm. usual with these people. Because then you're obligated, if a friend gives you a gift like this, then you're obligated to try to fulfill on it or to treat it well and to, to realize it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that raises the stakes in a certain way. And you hope at the end of it that you don't let them down. But that's also a motivation. So that's how we came to make that film, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in a note that I read, it says that the family that, or the same Los Angeles community depicted in Killer of Sheep, which I have seen, is in your film, Bless Their Little Hearts. Could you tell us a little bit about what the story is, and how close is that story, the story that Charles Burnett shared with you, to some of your ideas that you were thinking about as you were approaching your master's thesis project?
Oh, what happened was, I think maybe what you read, well, it's similar to Killer of Sheep in some ways, because what happens is there's a couple, and the couple has children.
Mm-hmm.
And this couple is played by a different actor, the husband,
mm-hmm.
but the wife is played by the same actress,
okay.
Casey Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And the children, who people confuse, they think they're Charles's children. They're his nieces and nephews. And what happened was the two older ones are in Killer of Sheep, but they're much younger. And then the little girl, Kim, their sister, she is new to the whole thing in the film. She's new. And she was a new little sister also.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first film for her.
Mm-hmm.
The story is basically the story of a worker, unskilled worker, a worker who might have had a factory job, and his wife, who also is a worker, and their three children. And what happened is the father becomes unemployed. We don't know exactly why, but he's unemployed. When we meet him,
mm-hmm.
he's looking for work. And he's you know, going to unemployment office, and also he's picking up day jobs, you know. He's mm-hmm. picking up any work he can get and to contribute to the family. And in fact, the family is largely being supported by the mother, okay, and by the wife, Casey Moore plays this role. Okay, and the three children are school children, school-age children. The oldest girl, in some ways, is the one who takes care of the younger ones and takes care of preparing dinner and managing the house until the mother and father are back in the house, you know? So it's about what happens to a family, what happens to a couple, what happens to the people involved under the strain and stress of long-term unemployment, huh? And the you know, expulsion of these people from the labor force. Now, what was happening at the time leading up to the film was that a lot of the major manufacturing industries in Los Angeles area were releasing thousands and thousands and thousands of unskilled and semi-skilled workers, right? And that was a job that you could raise a family on. You could maybe get a modest house. You could pay your bills. You could send your kids to school, you know. And you could have some hope for the future. And so that was given. That was reality in the city itself, right? And what was happening was being noted in part in, you know, different ways. But in the black cinema and cinema, there was not so much talk about this. And even among the schoolmates, the particular Charles was the one who had the closest links to that kind of situation. But he's a poet, and he was interested also that the other film, Killer Sheep, has a lot of history inside, you know. And this film, I think it has some of the, you know, the links to all of that. But at the same time, it was taking on an issue that was sort of central, but it's not simply topical. It also has a kind of history behind these people, who they are, where they come from, that kind of thing. Even if it's not telling you all of that, it informs the tone, the mood, and that kind of thing, right? And I think that interests me for sure. And also making a film about working class people to assert the culture, the values, the, you know, the things of the black working class people in a creative way, while it interests me. That was my interest, okay? And so that way, it was a way to make a film that was in part about that, and in part in solidarity with people in that kind of situation, you know, that they're interesting, they're valuable, they're beautiful, they're, you know, they struggle, they suffer, they make mistakes, and that also the struggle for a couple to maintain, you know, their relationship under the strain of the larger demands, you know, economic and familiar demands and all that kind of stuff, raising your kids, right? Mm-hmm. Those very real things. So I was lucky to have such a story.
Right.
And so that's how, you know, that's the part of it that interests me.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I was just thinking that, I was wondering if perhaps, you know, growing up in Texas and coming to Los Angeles, you know, there are a lot of Southerners that migrated to California for a variety of reasons, and the idea of employment, you know, being able to take care of one's family, is a theme that runs through quite a few of the films that are part of the program, L.A. Rebellion, because I think about the film of the one I saw last week by Manona Wally, The Gray Area, and it's about a man who, I believe, just getting out of prison.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the Black Panther Party, and he's trying to find a job, and it's
sure.
real different outside. I think he'd been in prison for like 7 years.
Yeah.
And he couldn't find anything. And then another film that I saw maybe a week or so before that, and I think it might have been a woman director, it was about this young man who had graduated from high school and wanted to go to college, and his mother was a domestic worker, and she wanted him to get on with the factory,
yeah.
and he wanted to be an attorney,
yeah.
And then she just has an epiphany. It's like, no, I'm not going to work when my son is graduating, so she decides to go to his graduation, and then she says, no, he's not going to be available, you know, to work in the factory. He's going to college, because she was just looking at how the woman she was working for was so proud of her son and his accomplishments and didn't know this woman at all, you know, her
I
internal
think that,
life.
Mm-hmm. That's a film by Toriano Berry.
Yeah.
He's the younger one. He comes later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Right.
Yeah.
It's called Rich.
Yeah. That's a charming film.
It is. Mm-hmm, it was. And then Shipley Street is also really charming as well. I mean, that.
Oh, yeah.
You buy
nice
Jacqueline movie. Frazier.
It's a very nice film.
Yeah.
I think they may, you know. They come a little later, but it's amazing how much life and how many of these issues they raise without being sort of, you know, they're not just solely about those issues, but they're how people contend with life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They contend with life, and then they overcome. I mean,
yeah.
They rise above it, which is so hopeful.
Yeah, sometimes they overcome, but the reality is, if they stay in the struggle, you know,
mm-hmm.
that then that's its own has its own value, because you may not overcome in the short term,
mm-hmm.
but maybe the, you know, you set the conditions, you don't give up if you mm-hmm. you hope, you see.
Right, yeah. And then I just loved Emma May, Jamal Sonica's film about this girl who, you know, came, you know, from Mississippi and to Los Angeles, and how she organized her friends. You know, the cause was, you know, well-intended, but, you know, the folks were, they didn't deserve all that honor. But, you know, organizing her friends to create a business and to raise money,
yeah.
and then they did so well, and then the racial paradigm, you know, shut them down because they
yeah.
were doing so well. I'm like, well, and then that is so true. I mean, back then and now too.
Yeah. That's one of my favorites of his films,
mm-hmm.
of all the films. But, you know, But, I mean, you know, Los Angeles is the black community is a large part. A lot of it, you know, have their origins in Louisiana and Texas, so
mm-hmm.
it's not so unusual. Mississippi is more unusual, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're here too. Arkansas people, but, you know, that's largely where that population comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, that Southern flavor is, it has, you know, the immigrants bring with them, even generations later, a certain type of a flavor and a certain type of values that are different than
But I think, you know, as the way that works is they're migrant people, so what happens is, and partly that's the films that construct that. You have to value that to recognize and acknowledge it. And not all northern and western and urban people, and also the generations who are born here,
mm-hmm.
they don't know that. In some ways, that's in Charles Burnett's films and in other films, because we sort of insist and we recognize it or we value it somehow. Not all the films have that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool, because not all the people share that experience, you know. They are people, young people who are born here. They don't know anything about that, and that can be good and that can be bad, you know. So.
Yeah, but we, you know, you talked about an inheritance, and I'm from New Orleans, and
yes.
my children were born here, and so what I bring, because I was raised here, so I don't, I mean, so it really is more intuitive than I actually bring something, because my parents are the ones that instilled in me those values.
Yes.
So I have to instill those values in my children and,
yes.
and connect it up for them. Like, well, even if you don't know the people, this is where it comes from.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, it's rich. And it's like how the tradition and what do you call it? What's, you know, the new thing that they are confronted with, that kind of thing. It's something that people have to work out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It used to be more pronounced because the way of transportation, communication, and all of that has been revolutionized. So everybody see the same shows, try to speak the same way, try to,
mm-hmm.
you know, move the same way. And if they don't go back and forth, and even if you go, you find the same thing, same music, same style, same everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, it belongs to an earlier period.
Right, yeah.
Part of the world is, you know, it's collapsed in the time and the space so that you don't experience this difference so dramatically, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But people have to decide if there are things of value in that. The fortunate thing is when people in... I mean, it still exists to some extent, and it used to be more prevalent, and it was partly what we could learn from the transition from tradition to modernity
mm-hmm.
in other places, in African films and in films from other parts of the world where the transition is more clear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The distinctions still exist. And then you start to value and wonder about how to look at your own situation and if those things pertain, you know? So that's part of the richness of what film could do at the time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now the challenges may be different or whatever. We have to figure it out, and the younger ones have to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Right, so. Yeah. But it's a good thing that everything is not homogenized.
Yeah.
Or pasteurized even. I noticed that, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you put in cinema sweat equity so that, you know, when you wanted to call in, you know, call in, you know, look at, you know, sort of your bank account, you'd have something there on the books. And so I noticed that you are actually in the film that Charles Burnett directed, When It Rains, and that's going to be not this week, the 11th, but the 18th when you're back in Los Angeles. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, being in front of the camera, you know, being an actor.
Oh, no, that was fun because, and I say I only do that for him. Other people ask me, but I don't do it. I'm not, you know, I was never aspiring or interested in that. But with him, he asked us to do it, and it's a very special thing because most of those people are friends.
Mm.
And they are friends that he got a commission to make this thing for French TV. And so he called, I mean, he told us, oh, I'm making this thing, and I think this is what I'm doing, and so I want you to, I'll give you a role. And it's just as simple as that. I mean, Charlie asked you, and it's a chance to do it, and also other friends, like John Rear, the guy who plays the guy who wants to propose to kill the guy and all that.
Mm-hmm.
He's an old friend from school. So in some ways, it was like the old days and it was our thing. I mean, he made that after making the other films, To Sleep With Anger and he was like a small project he made in between for French television.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with it, and yeah, for Charlie, yeah, no doubt, you do it. And it's fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So you don't think about it, you just, you do what he asks you.
Mm-hmm.
And you hope you do it okay, you know.
Yeah. And what are your films? What films have you made since Bless Your Little Hearts and Bless Their Little Hearts? And I know you teach at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television.
I teach at California Institute of the Arts.
Oh, you do?
I've taught there for like 25 years.
Oh, okay. So you know Wadada Leo Smith.
I know him very much. He's making a score for a film I'm trying to make.
Oh, seriously? Yeah, I spoke to him last year about the masterpiece, the opus he did for on the Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah. 10 Freedom Summers.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I know him well.
Oh, wow.
What happened was, like a lot of us, I was sort of interrupted in this filmmaking thing. I prepared another project. It didn't happen. Let's leave it at that. So what happened is then I had to get back to it. So what I did is I started making things that I didn't have to ask anybody. I started to make the small video projects. And then in 1990... what was it, 99 or something like that, a friend got a commission to make a work about the building of the Frank Gehry's Disney Concert Hall. So for 5 years I made this video documentary kind of project about the building of that concert hall, which is a big, cultural symbol of the city and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so for 5 years, I made a work about that called The Architect, the Ants, and the Bees.
Mm-hmm.
So what it's really about is the people who actually, the workers who actually build the building.
Mm-hmm.
And you see them building the building from the hole in the ground all the way till the finish of it. You know, with ellipsis and all that in between.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had an exhibition of that work, and then I've been working on another documentary film for some time. Hope to finish it next year.
Mm-hmm. Is that the one that Wadada Leo Smith is doing the score for?
Yeah, he will do some music for it.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I guess you can't tell us what it is until you finish it?
I shouldn't talk about it.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, hopefully we'll be in touch and you can let me know once you can talk about it.
Yeah, for sure.
That'd be awesome.
I'm not being coy. I just really shouldn't talk.
Oh, no. I understand. I mean, I would have been surprised if you would have talked about it, but I always ask just in case.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much
for this
wonderful conversation. It was really lovely, and looking forward to meeting you tomorrow. Are you in the Bay Area, or are you flying up later on?
I'm coming up tomorrow.
Okay. Excellent.
Okay.
Well, have a safe journey.
Thank you very much.
You take good care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.